And yeah, let's continue with our idea of having specific synchronization algorithms. Last time we've talked about the wait-free and the lock-free algorithms, and also we have started on the locking algorithms. And one specific incarnation of that was our implementation of a monitor, which would be a specific mutex structure. Mutex was the short name for the mutual exclusion mechanism, and our monitor is a special version of that in the sense that you implement it in a way that the mutual exclusion is re-entrant. So if you already somehow have gotten possession of that specific lock, then you can enter critical sections that are protected with that monitor arbitrary times. The only way that another threat can get hold of that specific lock is that you have passed that many release instructions as you have passed acquire instructions for that thing. So it counts the number of times that you enter the monitor, and only if you have passed as many leaves as you have passed enters, then the mutex is free to take for another thread anymore. So with that, we have seen, well, you already have to code quite a lot, like you have to put your thread ID into the data structure for the whole thing, and you have to have a counter for the number of times that you have passed enter in order to be able to free the monitor at a specific time. So now there's the thing that is still a pretty simple data structure in the sense that all you can realize is kind of mutual exclusion. If you want something more elaborate, like, for example, wait for a certain condition to come true, you always have to enter your protected area and do your relevant checking code inside, and if that turns out to be a failure, then you have to leave and hope that scheduling will, or the timing of other cores will lead you to a better result next time you try, and you will actually have something like a busy waiting on that lock, producing contention on the data structures there, and as you can remember, those things are implemented with locking cache lines there, and also obtaining cache lines at some point, and that is something which needs to synchronize between a lot of the caches of the cores. So this is occupying the system quite a lot. So having busy waiting on a lock is also something that is not desirable. So there's the idea of having something even more advanced, and that would be the principle of condition variables, in the sense that you would, instead of just having plain information about who actually is currently in possession of the monitor and how many times has that particular thread entered the monitor, you would also incorporate an arbitrary number of condition variables, which would somehow be associated with your particular condition of interest that you would like to check. So, you could imagine these condition variables to be somewhat related to the non-binary semaphore's counter, where you are interested at certain levels that counter reaches. So, you would have the special interests there, which would be then the condition variables. And you would introduce a kind of a protocol of how to access these variables, in the sense that you would introduce two methods that are dealing with these variables. More specifically, we would introduce a weight on such a condition variable, which needs to be, by your usage protocol, being called while being inside the monitor. So you have the exclusive access to such a critical section there. And in case that you have called wait on that specific conditional variable, the system would temporarily drop or release all the monitors and other logs that you had, and completely take your thread out of the runnings by queuing it in the blocked queue, and only reestablish this thread in the running queue when that specific condition variable is signaled. In that case, the runtime, or well, the protocol would mean that thread that has been waiting for that condition variable would then reacquire all the monitors and all these logs that have been held before, and return to action. So that is the function wait. Then there's the second one, which is its counterpart, the signal. And with a signal, a thread can flag to any other thread that is waiting on the condition variable on which the signal is happening, that it may continue executing. And there's several possibilities of how that might be happening. So first of all, there's variance in the number of threads that are waiting on that particular condition variable, in the sense that it's only one particular thread, you might not know which one, that is going to be awaking. And then there's the other notion where just all threads that have been waiting there are woken up once again and compete for the monitor once again, because, well, there's still the step of having to reacquire the actual monitor in which you should have been when you have called the wait instruction. So in the end, there will be only one who succeeds and be able to continue, and the others will have to go sleep again because they are blocked, in the sense that the monitor is then already given to someone else. So these are the first two notions. Then there's other things to consider with that. There's different semantics that you can give to your signal weight monitor construct. And there's the two principles, one being signal and urgent weight, which is one variant to do it. And that would mean that signaling thread completely gives control to the newly waking up thread and immediately goes to sleep. So the signaling thread will be put into some waiting queue. And then there's the other notion of having signal and continue. When the signaling thread, although it unblocks some waiting thread, still continues until it somehow exits the monitor, and only then the thread which is waking up is able to compete for the monitor. That's pretty abstract when just talking about that, so let's have a look at how you could kind of visualize that. Let's even though we always say that Wikipedia should be treated with caution when talking about a scientific topic, well, it nevertheless has a few good things in there. For example, these graphics here. So even that can happen. Yeah, so signal and urgent weight semantics. How do I have to think about that? Well, for once, there's kind of well, you could think about that in terms of a flat with several rooms, where this would be the area which is protected by the monitor. So there is one part that has to realize the queue, where all the ones who call the enter are actually having to wait in a queue. So that's the enter queue. And within this this monitor's room, you're allowed to call several specific methods. For example, well, if in that room you have the condition variables A and B, then you're allowed to call wait on the condition variable A, wait on the condition variable B, and you might also be allowed to signal variable A and signal variable B. So these are two things that are allowed in there. With a wait, you enter another queue over here, which is the waiting queue for A. Then there's a waiting queue for B. So each of the condition variables have kind of a waiting queue. And then there's also the call to signal, where you also have a separate waiting queue for all the processes that have signaled at a certain point and now have to go to sleep because there's an urgent other thread that has been waiting for that particular condition variable on which we have signaled. So these have to be running then. And yeah, in the end, there's also a mechanism for leaving the monitor's area. And yeah, the idea is that the thread that's currently active is able to enter the waiting queue by establishing a wait, and then it can't act anymore. Then new threads can be allowed in from the enter queue, and then these might now be able to signal on such a specific variable, for example, on A. And if that happens, then two actions are happening after each other. Well, first of all, these are now the first one in the waiting queue for A is now unblocked by signaling, and at the same time, the originally signaling process now has to go to the waiting queue on S, and the signaled process can then enter the monitored area and act until it somehow either waits anew or leaves the room. Yeah, so yeah, that's particularly one thing, so that doesn't matter so much. Then there's the signal and continue semantics of monitors with wait and notify. For those, there's you already heard me telling about notify. That is the special notion of signal in the context of a signal and continue semantics of the monitor. Here, life is a little bit different. Although there's still a queue that is to be entered before the monitored area can be accessed. So that is the monitored area once again. Here we have a little bit of a different setup. in the sense that now when we issue a signal as the currently active thread, we will, well, signal is in that case a specific notify. We won't have a state change happening here, so we will still be active and remain active until we decide to either issue a wait on some condition variable or leave the monitored area. And only then a new participant can enter the scene, which will be either one that has tried to enter the monitored area from somewhere outside, or is coming from, well, waiting queue on one of the conditioned variables and had been notified by some other process that has been issuing a notify before. So, yeah, that will lead for one of the queues to be popped at the start and added, and add the specific process to the enter. So we have the newly entering threads and the ones waiting on the waiting queues competing for access to the monitor in the same queue here. Yeah, and yeah, if it is implemented with a common FIFO ordering, then we will have this situation of competition there. And yeah, if you would like to have something more focused on trying to get rid of waiting threats fast, you might decide to modify that a little bit by introducing separate queues for entering and the notified processes, and give the waiting queue for the notified threads priority in extracting threads from there. But that depends on your personal choices. So for us here, we will have a look or a focus on specific implementation of those, and that's the signal and continue semantics, simply because there's less protocol overhead, in the sense that you have to touch too many different different waiting queues, and also we will concentrate on set up where we only have one condition variable in the monitor, because that is a setup that we will encounter in the wild quite often. So, but more for that later. So, instead of only having the monitor enter and leave from a few slides behind, we will now establish two additional routines, which are specifically concentrating on the waiting and signal, or in this case, notifying of the specific condition variable. So the others also exist, and they somehow share the common data structure for the monitor. So if the condition wait is called, for example, we can assume that the particular monitor is already in possession of the thread which is at that moment calling the condition wait, because that's the usage protocol, and you can assure that it is like that with static analysis on your source program, and make sure that the user keeps to the protocol that you have established for that. And that's what you get in these languages like Java or C#, whenever you try to call these wait and notify things. If you have not competed for the, or if you have not done that inside of the specific monitor, then you'll get an error message. So we can assume that the monitor is already in possession of our current thread. That's what we can assure with this assert. So that is kind of the precondition for condition variable weight. And if we possess that thing, we will also be interested in maintaining the correct amount of enters that we have had on that specific monitor. So, yeah, because during the wait, we temporarily release the monitor, we will have to somehow save the old amount of enters that we had on the monitor, and that's what we're going to do with that line over here, where we store away the old count of our monitor safely in a local variable. And now we're about to release possession of that specific monitor, and that's what we're going to do by setting the thread ID to 0 and, well, apply a weight similar to what we have seen in the old days of semaphores. So that weight is the one from the semaphores before, and that will actually just do the weight on the conditional variable as the semaphore and at that point. So yeah, we wait for that variable to become 0 in that case. So that will at some point deschedule our thread, and in the meantime we have released possession of the thread ID, so there's chances for other threads to perform actions within the monitor, and especially calling notify on the monitor and its particular condition variable. So that's what we're going to see on the other side. So while this one is waiting on the conditional variable, someone else can enter the monitor, and if it is inside the monitor, it can call the notify, and in there it will implicitly issue a call to signal on the conditional variable. So that is all what's left there for notify. Since we are in signal and continuous semantics, we don't have to go to sleep or anything else. Signal will just terminate like that. And if you turn back to the slide where signal was, it also performs no descheduling or anything else. So we will still be in running state and can continue on and either wait ourselves on some other conditional variable or at some point leave the monitor. Both of those will lead for the monitor to be free again. And yeah, let's assume that the signal, the notifying thread has left and done something else. Now we can we know that after the signal has been issued on the conditional variable, the wait will have terminated. So this thread can work once again. Another thing is that yeah, there can have been several threads waiting for the conditional variable, as well as other threads waiting to enter our monitor, and all of these somehow need to access or get access to the critical section protected by the monitor, so they have to compete for the monitor once again before being able to act inside the monitor. So what you see there is kind of quite parallel to what you have seen in the monitor enter. So what you need to do is you need to wait for the monitor to actually be available, which you can see by the monitor's thread ID being 0. And in case it is 0, what you're going to do is you want to enter your own thread ID in that. And that needs to be in a way that can't be interrupted, so you once again need the atomic actions. And same story as last time, due to this blocked way that we have introduced the atomic things, I also have the this count thing in the same thing, because it belongs to the same if, but yeah, doesn't need to be in the same way atomic as the other thing, so we could have done that somewhere outside, but we would have to open a new if, and that needs a lot of space. And yeah, for purposes of being compact, I put it in there, although it doesn't necessarily need to be atomic. So yeah, apart from these being atomic issues, the next thing what we need to do is we need to restore the counter of how many times I have entered my monitor to the old value that I have had before. So to, we have to re-establish the state that has been before. And yeah, with that, I can now, in case that I was next to enter, just leave or just not do the descheduling and leave the while loop and just continue on working. And in case that I haven't been able to get a grasp on the monitor fast enough and someone else has overtaken me, what will happen then is we will hit the deschedule and be descheduled again, this time waiting for the monitor's thread ID field in order to be modified again. And if that happens, I will just have to repeat well, not like this, the loop. Okay, so what we do with that is we actually connect the idea of a mutex with the idea of a semaphore and yeah, combine them to this mechanism of monitors being able to enter and leave and have non-busy weight approach for conditional variables. Okay, so in implementations out there, you will see different notions of this notifying mechanism. That's what I have already indicated a few slides beforehand. There's the plain notify, which is the notion that you have seen before, which just wakes up exactly one thread waiting on the condition variable. And then there's the other notion of notify all, which will not care about any queuing or something, which will just throw all the waiting threads into the ready queue and let them compete for the monitor. And yeah, in that case, the programmer has to anticipate that it's not only one thread that's going to awake, but there will be several, and the user has to re-evaluate the condition on which to wait and yeah, go to sleep once again. So yeah, that can cause a lot of trouble in algorithm design, but one needs to be aware of that there's several of these implementations and they might be mixed up in the naming. And yeah, you will be more as a programmer, you will be more secure in not assuming that as soon as you wake up everything will be will be clear for you to run, but you might want to reevaluate your waiting condition once again. So, yeah, you have to assume that you're not the only one who's waking up. Apart from that, well, I think that is things that we have already talked about, that there's a competition with other threats, especially with the ones that come from entering the monitor. So I think we can safely skip that particular thing. The next thing is, well, of course, there's implementation out there in practical systems. You might have already seen those in Java or C Sharp, and those are very specialized versions of the general notion, where you have a pre-built monitor concept already baked into the language concept, where you just have to use this synchronized keyword, or even I think there's also synchronized blocks and stuff like that, where you explicitly set a certain monitor. And the other thing is that there's implicitly just one specific condition variable baked into the system, so you can only have a specific wait and notify on that condition variable. So there's only one queue of waiting threats implemented in that. And yeah, so the idea is to have this synchronized, and then you can use the wait and notify directly. There's also a variant where you make where you somehow associate a variable with explicit monitor. So you have something like the, I think this is, it's a synchronize. I don't exactly remember whether you have a D or not, but you can take a reference to a variable here as your explicit monitor, and then you can call the wait and the notify on that particular identifier that you have on there, and that's kind of the same thing. It somehow mixes the concept of the monitor with the one of the condition variable, because it's a special case where there's only one condition variable which can then be mapped one-to-one on a specific monitor. So that's the implementation that you find in these managed languages. Good. So before we go on to deadlocks, is there still an open question on that? So, when talking about deadlocks, of course we are in the area of these locking algorithms. So, what do we mean if we talk about deadlocks? Deadlocks seem to be situations where two threats are competing for the same resources in some way, and they are waiting for the respective other to finish doing, because they need resources that the other has. And same way is for the threat for which the first one waits. This one also waits for termination of the first one, because it somehow needs resources that the first one has in possession. So this is, in principle, it's a question of cyclic dependency in the actions that those threats perform on their resources. So an example for that, you can you can construct such an example with the monitors that you know from Java, for example. So let's assume the following constructs, where we have a Java class, some arbitrary one, let's call it foo, which has reference to another one of the same kind. Let's call it other. And let's assume both of them have a monitor working. So they have, in this case, this specially baked-in version of a monitor with the synchronized keyword in the method modifiers. So in that case, this bar thing is assumed to enter the monitor of that object foo, and in there, what's going to happen is we will have a call to the bar method, which is protected by the monitor, which is associated with the other foo's monitor. So yeah, that's already deep into the details of how these monitors in these Java systems work. So if I write something like synchronized, there will be a monitor, of course, but you now have to think about what is the lifetime, what is the scope of the monitors associated with these things. And it happens that the monitor, which is meant with this special synchronized keyword, is assumed to be scoped per instance of the class. So each object of type foo has its own instance of a monitor, and thus, if I access the first monitor associated with my specific instance of this class, with my specific object, it will be a different monitor from the one that I access with this other.bar. So the other thing has its own instance of a monitor. So we will have two monitors in that setting, which will be the same thing as having two condition variables with that. And yeah, since in that setup I have a call to bar from inside another bar's another bar's instance, I will have two monitors involved in the thing. First of all, the monitor from my own class. And next, when I reach the call to bar of the other object, I will have the monitor of the other one involved, because I want to enter its bar version. So imagine a setting like this down there, where we have two instances or two objects of class foo in A and B. And either one has a reference to the other, so A has a reference to B, and B is a reference to A. And if we then somehow end up in a situation where we have parallelly started the methods A bar and B bar, both of them will start up, and there will be some legal execution of both of them, where both of them in parallel enter their respective monitor. So far, they are not depending on each other. And as soon as they now try to call their other's bar, they will reference their other or dereference their other field there and access the other object and try to obtain the other monitor, which is of course blocked because it's already in use by the other's bar. So there you go. You have two threads waiting for the other one to finish and leave the monitor so that they can enter them, and it's just not going to happen. So both block indefinitely. Good. So the question is, of course, that's something which is highly undesirable, because, well, that will just clutter our memory and lead to stalling programs. And yeah, we can now think about what we actually can do in order to get rid of these situations. So let's first of all consider a few observations that are there in connection with deadlocks. And it turns out that there are four conditions in the field of deadlocks which have to hold in order for a deadlock to actually occur. So what are these? First of all, we need a means of mutual exclusion being happening. So there needs to be a means for processes to require exclusive access to a critical section. So that is the first part that needs to be there. Then we need a concept for having to wait for exclusive access. So a process can hold resources while waiting for access to more of them. The next thing that we see is that, well, if the resources are not can be held while waiting, they need to be to stay at that specific process, so they cannot be taken away from them. And if then circular waits are possible, then we end up in a situation which we cannot solve anymore, which is then the deadlock. So all of them need to be to hold in order for a deadlock to occur. So, well, what can we do in such a situation? Well, there's several ideas for that. First of all, if you're in an unimportant area, we can just say, well, let's just ignore that. If we're in an area which where it's just an optionally not really mission critical that we always have a responsive system, then well, for example, in if you take a car, for example, the engine software needs to be responsive, of course, but the multimedia system, well, if it deadlocks, well, don't care. So that's one of the ways to deal with that, especially if the deadlocks are quite seldom. Well, they can be ignored. However, that's not the desirable approach, I would say. Then there's the idea of detecting that there's actually a deadlock happening, and in the case that we detect that a deadlock is either going to happen or has already happened, we can then take action. So we could either stall one of the processes, or we can take away resources from them, but somehow try to act against these deadlocks. Then there's the idea of preventing deadlocks, in the sense that we will examine the actual code that's gonna be run in our system and make sure that by logic there can't be any deadlock happening at all, which would be quite the elegant solution. And the other thing would be, well, the avoidance concept, which means that the operating system tries to somehow predict the actions that your current threat will be doing at some point, and in case that it has certain informations about your process, it might decide to not run into a situation where a deadlock is unavoidable, in the sense that if such a thing occurs, then it might stall your execution at that point and try to resume at a later point. Let it be with or without guarantees that you might starve in your program or not. That's not said with that, but in principle, the idea of avoiding to run into a deadlock would be another idea. Okay, so if you look at these different strategies, well, the ignored one is clearly one which is harmful. The detection means that you have to somehow preempt and take away resources which might screw up the original cause why you had your locks in place there, because you somehow, for example, have destroyed internal assumptions on the validity of your state. Then that defeats the purpose, and you might also have to have the means for taking away resources within your operating system, which might also not be given in all circumstances. And avoidance, well, for that you need some kind of higher intuition of what's actually going to happen in the programs, and also there's this problem of whether you might stall or not and starve at some point. And yeah, the real safe approach for the whole thing would be to prevent that any deadlock is actually really happening. But the question is, how could you do that? So, well, of course, there's the idea of not having a setting where you can actually wait at all. So just using lock-free algorithms would be one idea. For example, if you look at implementations of garbage collectors, that is kind of a hot topic where there's a lot of research going into preventing any locks happening in there. So, there's this idea of having a garbage collection running in parallel to other threads which try to allocate memory, and times where you have to shut down the whole execution of any other thread but just the garbage collector or the things that you don't want to do. So some algorithms without locking are the ones that are looked into. So there's a lot of different aspects of this garbage collection and memory allocation out there where people have come up with clever lock-free algorithms that get rid of certain parts of memory management that have had locking applied before. So that's, for example, an area where there's a lot of that going on. But apart from these special cases where you have a lot of thoughts baked into your code, when you have algorithms that actually require to lock because they have larger scale critical sections which you need to protect somehow, well, you might not have the option of just going over to a lock-free algorithm. So what you do for that? And the idea is that you tackle one of the other aspects that we haven't talked about before in this deadlock treatment, especially the circular weight. If you get rid of the precondition of circular weights being possible in your program, then you can safely assume that there's just no way that all the four conditions can hold, and thus you just can't have a deadlock in there. So if you can safely assume that there's no cycle possible in your logs, then you can say they're somehow partially ordered, and in these cases you can say there's just not it's just not possible to have a deadlock. Good. So how can we do that? Well, there's ways to try to come up with a partially ordered lock set. With lock set, what do you mean with that? Well, if we talk about programs, we can emanate from the concept that there's locations in programs, which would be well-defined spaces in your program, which would be positions between instructions. These are locations in your program which we would associate with this P. So we're talking about these locations in your program, and a lock set is referring always to a specific location in your program, and what is meant with a lock set is a subset of all the locks that are globally possible in your program, and more particular, what we mean with that is the subset of all the locks that may be held at that specific program point. So if you have a program or an algorithm that's somehow running, and you look at a certain program point in there, you might have several ways to reach that particular program point, because you have had some kind of a conditional branch over there, where you, for example, say that if X has been 0, you have gone on the right branch, and if X has not been 0, then you might have gone the left branch, and if, for example, over here you have acquired a lock, but they are not, then at that a program point, as well as all the others over there, control flow has merged again, and you can't say for sure, but you have to consider the case that at that point there may be a lock in possession of your algorithm. So what we have to deal with in our approach is these may sets of locks, meaning that in the set we keep an over approximation of the set of locks that will actually that we will actually hold at that specific point, because well, if we don't over approximate that, we might run into an explosion of states that we need to cover with that. Thus we will go the safe way and assume that we may hold that lock at that point, and we have to deal with the situation that it might be held at that point. So that's the matter with lock sets and this may notion of those and program points. Then, once again, we have the notion of transitive closure. First of all, quite general here. So transitive closure, what does that mean? So if we have a relation between two items, and we have the relation the way that one specific item x2 is in the second part of the relation here, and there's another member of our relation where x2 is in the first position of our tuple, then we assume that we can also relate x1 and x2 with each other, and thus assume that x1, x3 also have or also are in the same relation. So that is what we mean when we write plus as the index of relation sigma. Okay, so with that, we can now talk about something we call the log order. The thing is, now let's assume that for each of the program points P in our program, we track the log set of those, thus the logs that may be held until we reach that particular program point. Now, if we are in a program point just immediately before a new log is acquired, we have a situation where we now have a new member of the log order relation being introduced. So let's assume that how is it in that case? I have to parse that once again. So let's assume that we have a statement of the form wait on an L prime or monitor enter on L prime. So these two kinds of relations that are immediately following the program point in question, then we can establish for our log order that these logs L prime that are the object of our locking instructions here have to follow at a specific point in the order of the logs that we try to establish on our program. And in particular, they have to be ordered behind all the logs that are currently already held at the program point directly before the monitor enter or the wait. This P. So what we are going to do for that is that we will collect these new relations that we get by looking at each of the logs that we find in the log set at point P and establish that the L prime needs to come after each of these logs that are already held. If we do that consistently through over the program, we will get an order which is depending, of course, on the flow that our execution takes through the program according to the program logic. Thus, we will kind of have a ranking between the logs that reflects the order in which they have been taken. And in case that I leave a certain monitor or that I signal a certain log, I can remove it from the set of held logs once again and don't have to establish the log order with any other log that I will meet later on. So, with that, we can establish such a strict log order by performing the transitive closure on all the log order relations that we collect throughout our run through the program. And the thing is, in case that if we look after we've gone through the whole program and look at the log order relation that we have collected so far, if there and if you've performed the transitive closure on that order, then if we can't find any relation of the form A is in log order before A, then we can be sure that we have not found that we have no circular dependency between the acquisition of a log in some way, because well, if we have a situation like that, then through this transitive closure, we might have situations where we have two logs in one case being log A being acquired before log B, and in the other situation log B being acquired before A. And if we do the transitive closure, we will get to a situation where we have log order relations in the form A is ordered before A, and yeah, that's clearly not desirable. So in case that we don't encounter anything like that, then the program is said to be free of deadlocks, at least for programs with semaphores and monitors. And in case that we have monitors involved in there, well, monitors are the things where we can re-enter several times. So the things for if we also have those involved in our algorithms, we might need to look at a not so strong definition of freedoms, because well, in the case that there is monitors, we need to look at two separate sets of logs. There's the log set for semaphores and the log set of monitors, and we need to differentiate between them in our condition of whether we have deadlocks or not in our program, mainly in the sets of semaphores. We can we have to disallow dependencies on the same log, because well, semaphores need to be in the right order. And in case that for that we have monitor A from the set of monitors, then in case that we actually find a situation where we have A being ordered before B and B being before being ordered before A, then well, both of them need to be the same, and they need to be an A from the monitors. Otherwise, well, for semaphores, this is clearly not desirable. So, yeah, if we have only dependencies on ourselves for monitors, but not for any other log, then we can say the system is free of deadlocks. Okay. Good. So the thing is that this kind of approach sounds quite promising in the first hand. However, we always have to think about the ugly details also. And the thing is that when we talk about logs, we have to talk about instances of a log. So depending on how many times I reach a certain program point and where a new log is kind of created or something, it creates a new instance of a log. However, as I have talked with you about executions before already, if we differentiate between different runs through the program and have to take into account that variables may be an arbitrary value, and if we take all the values that a variable might be, and if there's loops or calls or whatever, depending on an evaluation of a certain variable, then we end up with a very large state space. So that is something that we cannot cope with. Already, if we just have a simple branching instruction which merges afterwards, we already create two different branches somehow, which might have different instances of something. And with that being a thing that we cannot compute in a meaningful time, we have to take measures to come up with anything meaningful at all. And for that, what we do is we don't treat all the instances differently, but we kind of summarize them. So, for example, what we can do is we can summarize all the logs that are created at a specific program point, although they might reside within a loop and be actually not one particular log, but there might be several, depending on how many times our loop is unrolled in practice. Or, well, there might be a log created in some kind of function procedure somewhere, and it might be called at many locations. No matter how, we just summarize them in one abstract lock, and those might in practice be several concrete ones, but we don't differentiate between them, but just over approximate, and as long as one of these locks is held at a certain program point, we assume all of them maybe being held at that point. That's why we have this notion of maybe lock sets. So we over-approximate clearly at these points. And thus, the thing is that if we mark them with a special flag as being over-approximations of locks and not particular concrete locks, then we might find that we still are able to generate dependencies between them. And as these are just over approximations, there need not be a concrete dependency, a concrete ordering problem between them, because there might still be a plausible way of arranging them if you differentiate between all the concrete instances of these things. But due to our reasons of having a terminating algorithm, we cannot differentiate between them anymore. And so although we find a cycle between these abstracted instances of a lock, there might not be an actual self cycle in the program. However, if we find that there is no cycle even in the summarized lock sets, then as those are over approximations and not under approximations, we can still safely assume that there's no deadlock in the program. So over approximation only does a mistake in kind of one direction. It's only overly eager in flagging that there might be a deadlock and not kind of missing real deadlocks. So we are still safe in case that we can show that in our abstraction we still have deadlock freedom. So the kind of the dark art is to choose the right locations for where to come up with a summarized lock and where to come up with differentiating between concrete locks. So that is kind of the magic behind that, and non-trivial in practice. However, for the examples that are that needs to be decided, we can still just try to deal with them in the way that we have seen there. So what we need to do there is, well, we need to set up our log sets. We need to differentiate between the mutex logs and the monitor logs. Also, we need to somehow flag up the summarized logs. And then we need to assort. We need to sort the logs into ascending order according to our log set principle. And then we have to check for cycles in the relation we set up with that. And in case that we can show that there's no self cycles in the non-summary monitors, then we are already pretty good. And yeah, depending on how we have abstracted the concrete instances of our logs, then we come up with whether there is actually a deadlock or not, or whether we might have a deadlock. So what do we do when our log order actually contains a cycle? Well, first of all, we have already established that log sets are only an approximation, as having exact log sets for each of the program points is not decidable for us. So although we might have a cycle in there, it still might be that there's no actual deadlock in practice. However, if we if we find that there is such a cycle, then we can take measurements against them by trying to make sure, by kind of manipulating the program in the sense that we can make sure that the logs that are conflicting with each other are only acquired in a certain way, meaning that if I give numbers to each of these logs and only only acquire them in increasing order, then I have modified my program in a way that there just won't be a cycle possible anymore in them. This might have special implications on the way that I deal with them. Especially, I might be forced to change the program into releasing my so far accumulated logs in order to reacquire them once again, in order to always be able to make sure that I keep to the order that I have established. And yeah, that might lead to a lot of performance overhead in the sense that we get a more inefficient algorithm, although it gets rid of possible deadlocks. And in the case that we have a cycle between summarized locks A and B, where we had to summarize in order to remain in computable areas of algorithms, then yeah, well, we're probably quite stuck in that case because we would have to somehow differentiate between logs that we have abstracted with summary nodes, and for that we would have to somehow refine our abstraction in a way that we somehow treat different logs differently in our algorithm without having a state explosion on the way that we associate log sets with program points. And yeah, that's quite tricky to do. So for our purposes here in the course, we are just stuck at that point. So yeah, an example for that would be the foo class, where we have monitors associated with this synchronized bar, and those would be created at the exactly same points in our program. However, being the deadlock would arise because we would have to differentiate between different instances of these things, and we have said that instances are things that we would summarize, and in these cases there's just a dependency between the summarized node and itself, and with that we just can't do anything to unwind that. So all in all, let's come up with a summary of what we have done so far for logs. And yeah, first of all, something about the connections between logs and our concept of having atomic operations in there. Logs and atomic or blocks that are marked as atomic are not quite the same things, although they are already quite close. If we try, for example, to replace the logs that are in there with atomic annotations, we see that there's differences in the expressivity of those things. For example, what you have in there is first of all, there's two different logs involved there. There's the log for weight Q, for QT, like this one, and then there's a log for QS. And they are somehow nested in each other. So if we just replace those things with atomic annotations, then we will... it will effectively just be merged, because having an atomic area inside an atomic area, well, that just doesn't change anything. Here now we can express different things, especially as we have kind of also conditions involved. So there's control flow also involved in the whole thing, in the sense that we decide to consider the area between those ifs as being atomic only when there's a certain condition holding at that particular point. And that's something which would need a major rewrite if we would do that with an atomic. We would have to somehow clone the area between those things and have them within an atomic block and outside of an atomic block, and depending on the C. So in terms of expressivity, it's not as easy as to just replace each of these log acquisitions and releases with just such an atomic thing. It's a more complicated thing. And on all, what I want to say with that is that it's not easy to replace each of them with the other, and it makes sense to differentiate between them. However, these atomic annotations around sequences of statements would be some kind of a very convenient way of programming. So although we might not arrive at the same expressivity as with detailed locking, we might still come up with ideas of just having these markers for atomic blocks and use mutexes to realize the atomic blocks in our implementation. And we could have different ways of achieving that. For example, we could start off with just a single lock and use that in order to protect all the atomic blocks. If we do that, we might for sure come up with a correct system, in the sense that, of course, they would not be executed at the same time, and they could be seen as atomic blocks in that case. However, there is a lot of potential for concurrency involved in that, because if I only have one global lock for all of them, clearly if they don't access the same data structures, then they can still could still be run in parallel. So having several locks involved would be better. So you could try to analyze the data that they're actually accessing, and if you're sure that two of these atomic blocks just don't interfere with each other, you could choose different particular locks for them to use. But you would have to group memory areas that are somehow touched in one particular atomic block, and you can have them cascading. So yeah, you would have to pay attention to what you lock with a different lock and for what you could use the same lock. Okay, so yeah. Apart from that, there's also the thing that the access order of variables in atomic blocks somehow also has influences on the locks that you have to use in order to realize these blocks, and yeah, so you have to take those also into account if you want to do automatically generate locked versions of your atomic blocks. And if you don't pay attention to that, you might end up with a deadlock once again. And lastly, if you start with too many locks in your implementation, you might also decrease performance because you always have to do all this different locking and releasing and acquiring another lock, which always has these kind of heavyweight instructions behind, with communicating cache lines, locking cache, and all these things. So at a certain level, the amount that you get in parallel in parallel execution won't pay off for the amount of performance that you lose by trying to acquire and release your locks. So that's not trivial, and thus not standard in program languages, at least as far as we have seen them here. In practical systems, how can you access the things that you have seen so far in the lecture? Well, in languages like C or C++, you have the ability to use the atomic operations that we've seen in the beginning directly. So we can implement weight-free algorithms there. We could always resort to these assembly instructions and use them in an inline manner, and that's also what the API actually does. When you use these wrapper functions for your compare and swap and all these things. The next tier languages with managed runtimes, you have higher level constructs for that, where you have monitors and other concepts baked into the language itself, which often simplify programming but have the problems of these deadlocks that we've seen. So what are the things that you can access from the different languages? Well, let's have a look at that. In C, C++, you get from different providers of compilers, you get certain implementations of barriers and API access to wait or lock-free instructions. If you use the right libraries, you can get semaphores and mutexes in C or C++. For example, for the pthread library, you get something like that. And in certain cases, you can also have monitors. Well, a few implementations of that library implement something like that. And the higher tier languages, like these managed Java, C Sharp, and all that, well, at least I have not seen these very simple synchronizing algorithms like barriers, but there's access to wait and lock-free algorithms with certain packages, like the concurrent atomic packages in there, and there's also in C Sharp this system and threading interlock packages where you get the wait and lock free instructions into your higher level language. Semaphores, those are things that you can somehow access with this synchronized methods thing or this explicit synchronization with these synchronized blocks. So that's what you get there. The mutex and monitor things are also directly baked into, so that's how you can access these things. So in summary, for our synchronization algorithms, what have we seen? We have seen the wait-free, locked-free, and locking algorithms. The only thing that we have not seen so far, what we're going to do next time, is transactional memory. Then what have we heard about the wait-free algorithms? Well, the important things is they never block, always succeed, never deadlock, have no starvation, and they can't do shit. They're just very primitive, limited instructions, mostly one or two assembly instructions combined into one large one, which can be performed atomically. So that's your wait-free algorithms, but with that you can already fulfill a lot of use cases. Then the lock-free algorithms, of course, as the name says, they never block. However, they may fail, they may starve, but they never deadlock. So far, so good. The thing that you buy into with that is that the invariant that your access with lock-free algorithms is only very limited. You can only access data that is, let's say, 8 bytes or something on Intel architecture. So you have to be very concise with the actual data that your invariant that you want to keep intact is spanning. So also quite limited. Then there's the locking algorithms, everybody's darling. They can guard arbitrary code. So in expressivity, we can do a lot of things in there. We can use several locks to have fine-grained concurrency and so we can allow a lot of things happening in parallel. However, we still have the downside that they might deadlock, and we have to choose between these notions of having re-entrant or non-re-entrant versions of that. Yeah. All in all, with the things that you've seen here, you can decide on the algorithm that best fits your problem or the features that you would like to offer in your programming model for your programming language. And we've seen all the implementations for that, so there should be no problem in implementing those. With that, that's the references that I've used for these slides. And I think we're also quite done for today. So next time we'll see how transactional memory and implementations in programming languages for that are actually working. So far, so good from my side. Thank you for your attention, and let's see you all on Friday.